Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant. I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this litigation update on Tennessee versus Cardona. Our moderator today is Sam Adkisson. Sam is an associate at Cooper & Kirk. His practice focuses on high-stakes civil rights, constitutional, and commercial areas. Prior to arriving at Cooper & Kirk, Mr. Adkisson clerked for Chief Justice John Roberts, Amul Thapar, and Judge Gregory Katsas. He also practiced law at Gibson, Dun & Crutcher and worked for then-chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Charles Grassley, during Justice Kavanaugh's confirmation process. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speaker, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speaker gives their presentation, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speaker, not the Federalist Society. With that, Sam, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Caroline, thank you very much for the introduction and for organizing today's panel. It's on an important and timely topic, and so very grateful to be here. As you know, today's panel is on Tennessee v. Cardona. It's a litigation update on Tennessee's important Title IX litigation, and we're thrilled to hear from our speaker today, Whitney Hermendorfer. Now, Whitney works in the Tennessee Attorney General's office, where she's director of the Strategic Litigation Unit. That unit handles some of Tennessee's most high stakes and important cases. Whitney previously practiced law at Williams & Connolly in Washington, D.C., where she worked on appellate and administrative law issues. She clerked for two Supreme Court justices, Whitney, which is quite impressive, Justice Alito and then Justice Barrett during her first term at the court. Whitney also clerked for then-Judge Kavanaugh on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals and Judge Leon on the District of Columbia Federal Court. Now, Whitney's a graduate of Princeton, George Washington University, and she's today involved in some of the most cutting-edge and interesting litigation in the country, I think. And so, Whitney, we're so grateful for your time. We're grateful to hear from you today. And to kick things off, if you could give us just a little bit of background about Tennessee's Title IX litigation.
Thanks so much, Sam, for that introduction, and to FedSoc for organizing today's panel. So many people, Title IX is one of the hottest litigation topics at the moment, and I think it's important to start with the statute. And that statute was passed in 1972. And pretty much everyone agrees that it was adopted to remedy the persistent discrimination against women in education. Women were being denied educational opportunities, denied admission to colleges, denied the opportunity to participate in programs like athletics. And so after a series of hearings on this issue, Title IX was passed by a widely bipartisan coalition in Congress. And the core prohibition of Title IX is found in 20 U.S.C. Section 1681A, and it provides that no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity. And the question that has arisen recently is whether the prohibition on discrimination on the basis of sex should be read to include discrimination on the basis of gender identity, which the government has defined as a person's internal subjective sense of gender. This is a novel reading. For 40 plus years, the statute was administered in a way that, as its text would suggest, it evaluated whether women were being treated worse than men and vice versa in the implementation of educational programs. And importantly, Title IX provides many scenarios in which It is permissible to separate the sexes so long as the programs and the methods are doing so are providing for equal facilities and opportunities. So, for example, the statute in Section 1686 expressly allows for sex-separated housing facilities like dorms. The statute elsewhere provides for sex-specific programs like Girls State and Boys State, Girl Scouts, beauty pageants, things of that nature. And I mentioned that to tee up kind of a later discussion about the bounds of Title IX with respect to gender identity. But there's no question that for 40 years, the statute was read kind of consistently with this text structure in history. So that's the statutory background, which brings us to, I guess, present day, Sam, and that starting in about 2014, so halfway through President Obama's second term, we started seeing more aggressive administrative attempts to interpret Title IX in a way that would encompass so-called gender identity discrimination. And so this was not something that Congress amended Title IX to permit. This is something kind of unelected agencies were doing, issuing things like guidance letters and dear colleague letters. And those letters in the course of 2014 to 16 started saying things like it violates Title IX not to use preferred pronouns, not to allow people to participate in sports or live in dorms consistent with their gender identity. I don't want to go on too long, but that's the general background in that. I think tease up what happens in kind of Trump one era and beyond. But I guess I can stop there if anything triggered any questions on your part.
Yeah, well, I think continuing with this background. And so at some point we get a new Title IX rule that's promulgated, right? And can you tell us about that?
Sure. So all of this effort kind of back and forth on the administration from administration about the scope of Title IX culminated most recently with President Biden taking office and I think doing the most aggressive interpretation of Title IX in that finally the Biden administration promulgated a notice and comment rule. Now, on day one, President Biden issued an executive order saying any statute in the federal realm that uses the term sex should be read to encompass gender identity. It's kind of an across-the-board rule. And as this played out in Title IX, what that first looked like was a set of guidance documents that were issued in I believe, around the summer of 2021. Those guidance documents provided that sex encompassed gender identity discrimination and that Title IX should be read that way by any university or school receiving funding. And I think that's kind of an important point in terms of the scope of how this applies. Title IX, a lot of people think about it in the sports context and they think about it as just being directed at universities and institutions of higher education. Title IX applies to any school that receives any sort of federal funding to support its educational programming. So the rules that the administration attaches to Title IX apply from pre-K all the way through college. So any changes to Title IX do have nationwide effect for most of the nation's students, and they also apply to private institutions that accept federal funding in the form of, say, grants for needy students or things like that. So Tennessee challenged the initial guidance along with a coalition of several states, and we obtained a preliminary injunction that was later affirmed by the Sixth Circuit on procedural grounds, arguing that the guidance that the Biden administration had put forward was such a sea change that it needed to go through notice and comment rulemaking. Fast forward, and the Biden administration did actually undertake notice and comment rulemaking. It put out two rules, one of which it said covered programs and activities, but that carved out athletics, and then put out a subsequent athletics only rule that purported to adopt kind of a different approach for athletics, but nonetheless did apply some gender identity mandates. So the rule received, the principal rule on programs and activities received many, many comments, tens upon tens of thousands of comments in opposition. And ultimately in April of this year, the department finalized the rule and it spanned 800 double-spaced pages and created a host of new gender identity mandates, as well as mandates with respect to the definition of harassment and broadening what it means to be actionable Title IX harassment, and also overhauling some of the requirements around due process and for the procedures those who are accused of Title IX violations are entitled to. So it's that kind of notice and comment rule from April that is the focus of the current litigation that's being pursued by a number of states. Tennessee sued to file filed a complaint to challenge that rule immediately upon its issuance. And in that coalition, it was Tennessee, Kentucky, Ohio, Indiana, West Virginia, and Virginia. And we filed that action in the Eastern District of Kentucky.
Right. So I think Judge Sutton said four states and two commonwealths, and you guys sort of banded together and launched this litigation.
Yes.
Right?
He's always one to abide the federalism principles. That's right. In describing things like that.
That's exactly right. And so if you could quickly walk us through what happened in the district court. I believe this was in front of Judge Reeves. Is that right?
That's right. This is in front of Chief Judge Reeves of the Eastern District of Kentucky. And upon filing our complaint, we filed a motion to expedite and really tried to put the pedal to the metal in terms of getting resolution around this. Because although the government had put down mandates that were going to fundamentally change how schools operate and the facilities that would be required, I shouldn't take for granted that people know what these, when I say mandates, what I mean is the two core mandates of the new rule are that anytime there is gender identity discrimination, it is per se sex discrimination and violates Title IX. The second rule that goes hand in hand is that it is per se unlawful to deny a person access to a sex-separated space or program consistent with their gender identity. So that means if there's a boys and a girls bathroom and a boy identifies as a girl, it violates Title IX for the school not to allow the boy to use the girls' bathroom. So, and that carries over in any number of aspects from PE class to sex education class to locker rooms, et cetera. So obviously that would be quite a change for many of the nation's schools, yet the government gave schools only 3 months over the summer to get themselves into full compliance. So we challenged and immediately sought a preliminary injunction against the rule to try to stave off the many harms our states and our schools would suffer from having to comply. A group of interveners represented by Alliance Defending Freedom also came into our case to challenge the rule. And ultimately, after a hearing in which Chief Judge Reeves heard from several witnesses that the state put forward to explain how the rule would harm the state's interest, Chief Judge Reeves issued a 93-page opinion that Chief Judge Sutton later commended as thorough, explaining that the rule violated or likely violated the Department of Education statutory authority, constitutional principles, in particular the First Amendment and Spending Clause, and also was defective under the Administrative Procedure Act because the agency had not considered and adequately responded to the many opposing comments talking about the privacy harms and the equal opportunity harms the rules mandates would cause students. So So we thought, you know, we got a preliminary injunction and we were very pleased with that. And then, you know, the government, there were proceedings following that, I guess I should say.
Right. And before we go further, I should mention if anyone has any questions, they should drop them in the Q&A queue, and we will get to those at the end. We're going to spend another 10 or 15 minutes going through things and getting the full update, and then we'll pivot to questions after that. And so Whitney, the district court enters the preliminary injunction, but then the government comes along and they ask the district court to stay its ruling and to reconsider it, right?
That's right. What they did was, I think, a few different things, all under the auspices of seeking a partial stay of the injunction. So what the government argued was, which was number one, which was, I think, akin to more of a motion for reconsideration, is Chief Judge Reeves erred by enjoining what we call the Bostock provision of the rule, because the Supreme Court's decision in Bostock should apply to Title IX. And of course, the Supreme Court's decision in Bostock held that for purposes of Title VII's employment discrimination regime, it is discrimination because of sex to discriminate against persons of transgender status or based on sexual orientation. So the government says that should likewise apply to Title IX. And under that reasoning, Chief Judge Reeves was incorrect to enjoin the prohibition on gender identity discrimination. Beyond that, the government, I think on the stay portion of the appeal, did not defend meaningfully the rule's application to sex-separated facilities and the rule's redefinition of sexual harassment to include things like misgendering, then use of pronouns inconsistent with someone's gender identity. It instead said the rest of the rule should take effect because the court can kind of carve out the defective provisions for purposes of the preliminary injunction, and schools should apply the rule otherwise on the provided timeline. And ultimately, Chief Judge Reeves, in another lengthy opinion, and the motion, my motion lights just went off. The Sixth Circuit motions panel, comprised of Chief Judge Sutton, Judge Batchelder, and Judge Mathis, ultimately concluded that the injunction was fine as is, should be maintained, and that the government was incorrect that you could kind of roll out this partial compliance regime and that would force schools to basically double train both around the preliminary injunction and then later upon final judgment in the case. So, and then we weren't done yet.
Yes, and I promise our viewers there won't be too much hand waving on this call, but if you do need to move to make your lights go back on, Whitney, we certainly understand.
Yeah. We'll
but I, as a Tennessean, I'm always glad to see the state trying to save the taxpayers money and being mindful of that. But
exactly.
So in the Sixth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit declines to grant emergency relief, right?
That's correct.
And then it goes up to the Supreme Court, right? The government asks the Supreme Court to step in and grant emergency relief and grant an emergency stay. And so what happens there?
That's right. So what we saw were parallel proceedings where the government had, in addition to Tennessee's preliminary injunction, the dominoes really started to fall in a number of other challenges to the rule that were brought across circuits. So there were challenges brought in the Fifth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, Eighth Circuit, Tenth Circuit, Eleventh Circuit. And what we saw was one by one, district court judges of all, appointment eras agreeing that the rule was unlawful. So, at that point, both Louisiana and Tennessee were in a very similar posture because the government likewise moved for a partial stay of the injunction in the Fifth Circuit using identical arguments it brought in our case. And both the Fifth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit rejected the government's arguments on largely identical with similar reasoning. So at that point, the U.S. Solicitor General's office got involved and brought a stay application, both from the Fifth Circuit's judgment and the Sixth Circuit's judgment. And
Whitney, just for our viewers, when we say that the Fifth and Sixth Circuit rejected these arguments for pretty similar reasons, can you tell us a little about what those arguments were? I think there was something about maybe the statutory definition and then something about the regs being intertwined, but just a brief explanation there for our friends watching.
Sure. So both the Fifth Circuit and Sixth Circuit, and I would direct people to Chief Judge Sutton's opinion for the panel in particular, rejected kind of at least preliminarily the notion that you could apply Bostock's reasoning to Title IX on the ground that Title IX is a very different statute with respect to how it treats sex and how it allows sex differentiation throughout. So on the merits, the most merits portion, I guess you would call it, of the stay application, both the Fifth Circuit and Sixth Circuits were skeptical about the government's arguments that Bostock should apply in defense of the gender identity non-discrimination rule. Otherwise, the courts also were skeptical that you could parse out the lawful portions of the rule from the unlawful portions. And we had briefed kind of in a supplemental briefing all of the ways in which the prohibitions we had attacked and received relief against were intertwined with the broader workings of the rule. And so, for example, the definition of complainant turns on what type of sex discrimination is cognizable under Title IX. So too with relevant evidence. I think the notion of what sex discrimination means is incorporated prolifically throughout the remainder of the rule. And of course, if you're training, there's a new obligation to train teachers, for example, that was justified on the basis that they were expanding the meaning of Title IX in a way that you would need to train teachers about. Of course, if the premise goes away, then there might not be a need to train teachers. So whether you want to think about it in cost benefit terms and rationale terms, the rule cannot stand alone without the three central provisions that were defective. And so that is the reasoning that the Fifth Circuit and Sixth Circuit applied with respect to the scope of relief arguments. And those are kind of the buckets of arguments that went up to the Supreme Court.
Yeah. So then the Supreme Court steps in or is asked to step in by the government, and by a 5-4 vote, they declined to grant relief. It's with Justice Sotomayor, Justice Gorsuch, Justice Kagan, and Justice Jackson dissenting, right? Can you tell us about those proceedings?
That's right. So as mentioned, the U.S. Solicitor General asked the court to issue the partial stay of the injunction, both in the Fifth Circuit case and in our Sixth Circuit case. And what we saw was actually pretty rare. And that is, we saw a full binding opinion from the Supreme Court issued kind of on the stay docket over the summer. We're used to seeing per curiam just orders with separate writings or things like that. But the court issued a binding opinion. And the court held that with respect to scope of relief, the government had not made its showing that the rule could be stayed or partially implemented in the way that it was suggesting. And then we saw something really interesting when the court was talking about our challenge to the three principal provisions. And the court, in both the majority opinion, which is unsigned, it's a per curiam, and in Justice Sotomayor's dissent, said that all nine justices agree that the principal provisions of the rule, so the Bostock provision, kind of the provision about sex-separated spaces, and the harassment definition as applied to gender identity, said all nine justices accept that the states were entitled to preliminary injunctive relief against those provisions. And then Justice Sotomayor repeats that in her dissent. So, you know, at a minimum, the court was expressing, I think, grave doubt about the merits of the opinions. And of course, we later argued that circuit court should follow that Supreme Court instruction on the three principal provisions.
Yeah, and so that gets us closer to where this case is at now. So at the end of the Supreme Court's per curiam opinion, they noted that the Sixth Circuit had expedited the appellate proceedings, which they seemed pleased with. And then the court, as it does on occasion, said that it, you know, expected the lower courts to decide these cases, you know, in a sort of a preliminary injunction posture with all appropriate dispatch. You know, in Supreme Court terms, that means, you know, step on the gas a little bit. And right. So your case then is in the Sixth Circuit, and you you're briefing the preliminary injunction, right? And there was an argument held in late October. Is that right, Whitney?
That's all right.
So give us the status, the sure. Most up-to-date, where things stand now in the Sixth Circuit.
Sure. In the Sixth Circuit, the preliminary injunction appeal is fully briefed. As you mentioned, the case was argued on October 30th before the panel, and now that case is pending decision by the court. Simultaneously, we were briefing summary judgment to the district court, to Chief Judge Reeves, and it was the first and probably only time in my career I will have a filing day that is both a Supreme Court stay opposition and a motion for summary judgment in the same case on the same day. And so, you know, we urged Chief Judge Reeves to keep the case moving forward and ultimately issued a briefing schedule that involved us having summary judgment fully briefed by mid-September. And so too in the district court, there are kind of ripe summary judgment motions pending decision. So it remains to be seen, I think, you know, the sequencing and how things move forward, but that's the current status of our case. I think you will start to see kind of the PI arguments occur over the course of the next few months in all of the other cases. Louisiana argued its preliminary injunction appeal, I believe it was November 6th or thereabouts before the panel. I think the 11th Circuit argument is next month. I haven't kept track of all of the other arguments, but I think we can expect the PIs to be argued over the next the course of weeks, and hopefully we have our fingers crossed for a good result. Of course,
right? Can you tell folks a little about what the government's arguments were like in the Sixth Circuit? I know the case is pending, so I don't want to get too much into from you, anyways, into what the judges were asking or what their questions were like. But what were the government's main arguments?
So I think, you know, their main argument all along has been that principally the court should apply Bostock, and the government has never really advanced a kind of de novo reading of Title IX. It hasn't run the traditional text history structure type of argument. It really just views Bostock as a shortcut that allows you to circumvent all of that. And it equates on the basis of sex with because of sex in the Title VII context. So it again went all in on Bostock. One thing that I think was interesting was that the government really, by the time of oral argument, was not wanting to keep the focus on the sex separation provisions. And it was really, you know, apply Bostock. And that was the bulk of the argument and the bulk of where the argument, at least the oral argument, was focused. And I think that's kind of always been their lead argument with respect to the statutory authority claim.
Very good. Well, I think that's a great update. Now, I have just a couple of questions, and I think they may overlap some with our audience's questions too, but so I'll go into those, and then please keep submitting your questions, and we'll get to those after this. But the burning question on my mind, and I think some of our viewers' minds, is, well, look, there was an election, if no one has heard about that yet, and there was a change in presidential administration. And I think it's, you know, no secret that the Trump administration will think about these issues a little different than the Biden administration. I think this was certainly a topic in the campaign. And so what effect, if any, do you think or do you see this change in administration having on the Title IX litigation moving forward?
So I think, it's no secret, like you mentioned, this was an issue in the campaign. But I think the way I'm thinking about it as an advocate for my client is until I have full certainty and full relief, we're going to keep pressing forward with what we think the right legal answer is. And, to the extent there are later changes in the case that would occur, for present purposes, our position has not changed. And that is, we have fully briefed, summary judgment, and we argued the PI, and we think we are entitled to relief from this rule, not only preliminarily, but because through vacatur under the Administrative Procedure Act. And so until we get kind of that ruling of clarity about our obligations moving forward, we're going to keep fighting for our clients' interests because as Judge Nalbandian wrote in his opinion on the guidance case, which I would commend to everybody on this call to read, it's from June of this year, affirming the injunction against the Title IX guidance. The mere fact that there are these promulgations on the books harms the regulated entities in and of itself. And so, that was why we pressed forward to seek summary judgment briefing in addition while we were briefing the PI. It wasn't so, it certainly wasn't the option that got our attorneys more sleep, but it was what we felt we needed to do to fully protect our clients' interests. And so I think thinking about it from that advocacy lens is how at least I'm approaching things. And I think, everything else kind of falls away, honestly, at that point.
Well, and the rule is still in place, right? And I mean, the government hasn't conceded that the rule doesn't apply or anything, has it?
No, that's correct. And, the rule is in place. And, I think just beyond the client's interest point, I think if we think back to what happened to the Title IX guidance with President Obama's second term, there was a case that the Supreme Court granted a stay in about the meaning of Title IX and whether it encompasses gender identity. We then saw the Supreme Court had granted cert, and it was at that time when President Trump came in, and because that was guidance, rescinded the guidance, and the case ultimately was dismissed. And, running kind of the counterfactual world where the court would have decided that case and given clarity, I think would have been highly beneficial for regulated parties and schools and students alike. And so there is a value in saying what the law is when you have a live case or controversy for purposes of allowing states and regulated parties to order their affairs accordingly.
Right. And I mean, I would note, the Supreme Court's opinion or order in this case, came down in August, right? Mid-August. And the court said, look, issue your rulings, lower courts with appropriate dispatch. It would be pretty surprising if the lower courts, waited more than 4 months to issue their opinions. I'm hopeful that we'll get some rulings on this and that you'll get some certainty, but I guess one never knows for sure. Whitney, before we go to our audience questions, is there anything else you think we should know about this case, or have we covered the ground?
I think we've covered the ground, without resorting to, a commonly used phrase. I do think this boils down to a who decides question. And we've seen Congress try and fail to amend Title IX in the way that the current administration, the department, is reading it. And so it really is a case about can we be administratively updating statutes to fit kind of present day senses of how things should operate as a policy matter, or is that the work of Congress through, you know, bicameral legislation? So that at its core, I think some people would say most cases boil down to a who decides question, but I think certainly this one does. And that's how I know many of the judges who have written in this topic have seen the case as well.
Very good. Well, thank you so much, Whitney. And now I do want to go through some of our audience questions. And again, reminder, if you have anything, just type it into the question and answer box and we'll get to it if we're able to. But our first question is sort of a fun one, kind of a spicy one, okay. Which asks, if the Trump administration actually dissolves the Department of Education, which would seem to imply no more federal funding at all, I mean, would any Title IX enforcement even continue to apply? You know, well, I don't know what DOGE is going to do in our, you know, our friends who are going to run that new component. But any thoughts on that, Whitney?
Well, my first thought would be we probably still need clarity, I suppose. Title IX has a private right of action, an implied cause of action. So not to get too nerdy, but I would want to know how that legislation looks and whether the Title IX private right of action is still in place absent the funding. You know, beyond that, actually, Tennessee did a very interesting government-wide study on what would happen if it declined all federal educational funding. I think as we've started to see some of these more policy-based reaches around, you know, what we think funding conditions can contain, some of the states have taken a second look at whether they'd be in a position to turn down Title IX funding and any other federal funding. And I think the answer is it's going to be extremely difficult to forego, at least as currently structured, the federal educational funding. And that was part of what our witnesses testified in a very compelling way to, because, you know, there are real students with immense need that are going to be harmed by the government pulling states' funding for not following these gender identity mandates. So we're talking, you know, free lunches, Pell grants, after school programming, all of those historically Black colleges, all of these funding streams that are directed towards important programs would be eliminated in a way that the state would really not be able to rectify with its own funding. So it's an interesting thought experiment. And if it actually happens, I will, of course, have to think about, you know, how that affects things moving forward.
Yeah. Very good. Very good. I think, you know, the lawyers will still find a way to sue is what I'm hearing, but it's an interesting thought experiment. Our next question is an interesting one. And I think it gets into some of the things and sort of considerations around how these multi-state coalitions come together to challenge rules or regulations. But the question is, it says, the six states presumably could have sued in their own courts or in federal courts sitting in those states. So what's the rationale for these four states and two commonwealths to be teaming up and suing in the Eastern District of Kentucky? You know, your office is in Tennessee, Whitney, so what can you tell us a little more about that?
Sure. So I think, you know, the volume of federal regulations we saw, just for context, in April of 24, which is when Title IX came down, it was a month of the single most federal rules released in the history of the country. And we're hundreds and hundreds of rules were promulgated just in the span of the month. And so by necessity, it makes it almost a necessity to pool our resources. Tennessee is a very fortunate position that we have this standalone unit of strategic litigators who primarily focus on offensive litigation. But many, many states are not as resourced or not in the same position. And so I think for federalism purposes and for purposes of being able to effectively push back on the volume of federal mandates we're seeing, it does become necessary to partner up with states and can be very beneficial. Tennessee, for better or for worse, has encountered many of these kind of gender identity related issues in its prior litigation, and become and has developed somewhat of an expertise and know-how in litigating these types of cases. And what you see is the states kind of divvying up those subject matter areas and leading various coalitions. So, you know, I think there are, beyond that, there are, of course, as any good plaintiff's lawyer will tell you, there are other considerations that go into where and when to file and who to sue and what claims to bring. And of course, strategy is a part of that. But I think the fundamental phenomenon of states partnering up in these multi-state coalitions really is a nature of necessity. And if each state needed to sue to challenge each rule independently, there would be just too much and it couldn't be done.
Okay, that's great, and that's helpful to know. Our next question asks about consent decrees, basically, and the premise of the question is: are states able to enter into a consent decree with a new administration after, you know, the administration changes, if their position does, or does one have to go through notice and comment to repeal a Title IX rule? And as a corollary or related question, would the answer change if a judge anywhere enters a final ruling in any of the Title IX cases, presumably a ruling of vacatur?
So I think it's the ins and outs of this is an open question. And of course, we saw many, if not consent decrees, we saw settlements, we saw voluntary dismissals in cases when the new Biden administration took office. And kind of one of those scenarios made it to the Supreme Court with the public charge rule. I believe in that litigation, all but the government dismissed its appeals and all but I think a case that had granted either a nationwide injunction or vacatur of the public charge rule. And you saw at oral argument, the case ultimately there was never an opinion issued.
It was a dig in that case, right?
That's right. There was
dismissed as improvidently granted.
Yes, which is shorthand for, oh no, we don't want to deal with this right now. So the court digged the case. The chief had a separate writing, kind of raising some of the issues of how notice and comment principles might interact with vacatur settlements and all of those things. So I think this is an unsatisfying answer, but I do think this is one of the areas of law, along with kind of remedies and APA remedies, that there is still pretty under-theorized and not much by way of kind of governing precedents to look to. But it will certainly, if that ultimately materializes in a way, I would expect that there will be ultimately litigation about, further litigation about all of these issues should we see position changes playing out in the way that the question would suggest.
Yeah, and so, you know, as we continue to think down the road, our next two questions sort of go into what might come up next. And so one gets into this sort of new administration, inauguration, change of attorney general. I mean, one thing that people could be looking out for would be a change in the administration's position, right?
I think there are different ways that would be effectuated. And what we've seen, for example, is sometimes the government, and I would kind of refer everybody to a case that's occurring in Maine right now, where the government was defending a Department of Defense rule about funding health insurance for transgender-related surgeries for former military members and their dependents. What the government did there was it defended against the case really on standing grounds only and was silent with respect to the merits. So I think all of that is to say there are ways to potentially defend a judgment without defending fully the merits of the judgment or to challenge a judgment And it will, you know, I think for my purposes, I will take all of that as it comes. We, of course, you know, do think the rule is unlawful, but in the first instance, we think that the job, the person who, people who should be adjudicating that or the judges with kind of the live motions before them, instead of kind of hypothesizing about events that might come down the pike. Because like I said, my number one goal is to get clarity for our client, and for our schools. And that, you know, is not going to be furthered by kind of trying to play a guessing game about what the administration might do and what form that might take, you know, into 2025.
Right. And another question we have here is, could supporters of the Biden administration's Title IX regime challenge the Trump administration's probable repeal of them? If so, on what basis? And I suppose your answer to that might, you know, probably depends on whether there's vacatur of the rule and the Trump administration is able to write on a clean slate. But, you know, just maybe give us a little administrative law take on what that might look like.
Sure. So I think certainly if the Trump administration wanted to undertake a new, either what's called a repealer rule or just a modified Title IX rule with different requirements and different reading, that typically would be, there are exceptions. So I don't want to paint with too broad a brush. For example, if you're just implementing a Supreme Court decision, for example, some think that that type of rule does not need to go through notice and comment. But as a general APA matter, if the government adopts a new rule, and we saw this in the kind of DACA would be the most famous example where an administration was kind of dinged on APA grounds for trying to repeal a rule. Typically, that type of rule would be subject to notice and comment and ultimately challenge. I think, like you mentioned, there are perhaps a different route if the rule is subject to nationwide vacatur. And that's kind of that area where the Supreme Court has not weighed in fully to discuss how those kind of APA standard remedial principles would interact with the notice and comment rulemaking principles that you'd otherwise would apply if the government wanted to promulgate a rule that took a new tact.
Yeah, that's great. And I think that's very helpful. Our next question comes from someone who serves on a board of education in the Northeast. They say, we already have state laws allowing boys and girls bathrooms and locker rooms. Some on the board of education want to update policy language to be consistent with the recent Biden regulations. This person wants to, you know, wait and see what the Trump administration does. You know, and I think the question is if the language and policy gets changed now, if Trump reverses that regulation with a new rule or an executive order, will the board have to conform its conduct with the new federal ruling? I mean, I don't want you to give legal advice to this school board per se, but I think, I mean, I guess my take, Whitney, would be that, you know, certainly a board of education is going to have to comply with any new rule if it receives federal funding. But what's your, anything you want to add or any additional context you want to give us there?
Sure. So, you know, I think following federal law is generally a good approach. But I do think that question really kind of strikes at what the Title IX federal rule is doing as compared to local and state regulations. I think, you know, one thing to point out is that as it currently stands, states are free to adopt gender identity-based protections, and many states have, you know, including as the state in the Northeast. So that state and local solution is what kind of Tennessee is seeking to advance versus this kind of one-size-fits-all federal mandate. And so if the federal rule is vacated, that does nothing to stop states who want to provide this protection from doing so. Of course, if there was a new Title IX rule, you know, putting additional content on what it means to discriminate on the basis of sex as it relates to gender identity in programs, that would be a different issue. But for present purposes, getting rid of the Title IX rule as it currently stands would do nothing to stop states from and local entities from adopting whatever protections they see fit as a policy matter.
Well, that's great. And so we've answered all the questions. If anyone has any more, please submit them now. We'll give one more look at things. But seeing none, I think we're going to turn things back over to Caroline, who organized today's event for the Federalist Society. And I want to say thank you, Caroline, for setting this up. And Whitney, thank you so much for your insightful comments and all the work the Tennessee Attorney General's office has been doing on this important case. Caroline?
Great. Well, thank you both so much. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you for the benefit of your time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.